Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For New York Times economics reporter Ed Andrews, a nest in the suburbs promised a new lease on life with a new love. He bought his house at the height of the housing boom. It all crashed into a smothering pile of debt. Like millions of Americans who have faced or will face foreclosure, it's the story of how home sweet home became a nightmare. This hour, On Point economics reporter Ed Andrews takes us into his own credit crisis and the story of the nation's housing meltdown we've just come through. Joining me now from New York is Edmund Andrews, a veteran economics reporter for the New York Times. In 2004, he bought a house he couldn't afford. He's been paying for that decision ever since. Ed, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
You've been talking about this a fair bit in recent weeks with the book out, and the book, of course, Busted, Life Inside the Great Mortgage Meltdown. And I can see online and elsewhere you're getting a fairly robust range of response, Ed, everything from sympathy to people very ready to kick you and others in your circumstances to the curb.
Absolutely right. I have gotten a huge response, both, hundreds of letters coming in from readers of the book excerpt that appeared in the New York Times magazine, and then on blogs and all over the internet. And there's definitely a collection of voices out there, people who write and say, "You're an idiot." Or some of them go further and say, "You're a crook and you ought to be disbarred from journalism and how could you? You should be ashamed of yourself." And I think I had one letter from a person who basically said I was, tantamount to being a member of Al-Qaeda.
bringing down a great nation with your tomfoolery.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, of course, you expose yourself to that when you lay out your foibles as openly as I did here. The surprise, actually, though, is that at least in the mail that I have received, it's the overwhelming response from readers has been not only positive, but sort of thankful. The most common message I get is people saying, "Thank you for being so open about your situation. Mine is like yours in this way or that way. Mm-hmm. It sounded just like what we've been through, and I don't feel so alone or ashamed of myself anymore. I know that there are other people like me." And I got to say that has been a very moving experience for me. I've been kind of overwhelmed by it because you can tell so many of these people are, they're hardworking. They're people with families, and they made mistakes. They all have different stories, but it's not like they're con men or anything. They were people who are struggling and trying to figure it out. It's quite heartrending, actually.
I'm sure we'll hear from our listeners on this, and before we're finished, we'll ask what message or what, verdict you think you and your story deserve. But give us a little bit of the story first, Ed, for those who haven't heard it. It's 2004. And you're talking to you get the number of a loan officer at American Home Mortgage who tells you, "I am here to enable dreams." What happened?
That's right. Well, to set the stage here a little bit, in 2004, early 2004, I was had come out of a long, turbulent marriage and was paying very, very high child support payments and alimony, but I had fallen madly in love with a woman who I have since married, but I was just head over heels in love, and I was trying to figure out how to, how to start this new chapter in my life, and we both had quite a few children. Patty, the woman I married, mm-hmm. had four children, but two young ones that she was going to bring with her to live with us, and then I have three boys who live very close by, and we're going to be, coming over to where we live as much as they could, and turned mm-hmm. out to be all the time. So, I was just totally in love, trying to figure out how to do this, And I was referred to a mortgage broker by my real estate agent who said, Bob can deal with, you know, complicated situations. And Bob really could at American Home Mortgage. He basically only had one question for me, which is, can I pull your credit record and find out what your scores are? And my credit ratings were high at that time, over 700. So he basically said, you know, I can lend you up to $500,000. How much do you want? And I said, well, you know, my situation's a little complicated here. I've got these obligations. And he just kind of brushed it aside, saying, you know, that's not a problem. I specialize in this kind of thing all the time. You know, we can make it happen.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was the easiest thing in the world. Basically, it took a matter of weeks to borrow $460,000 to buy a lovely little three-bedroom house in Silver Spring, Maryland. It was a loan. You've heard of liar's loans.
Yes.
Where somebody...
Say anything on this loan about your income. Say anything.
Yeah, exactly. You put down whatever you want for your income, and they don't ask you to document it, so nobody really checks. My loan wasn't actually like that. For kind of complicated reasons, it went a step further. I actually didn't even put an income down. There was literally nothing on the blank, the section of the loan application where you state your income. This is called a no-ratio loan.
Or a pig in a poke. They knew nothing about what you could bring to the table.
Essentially, all they knew, all they cared about, and, you know, there was no deceit here, right? All they wanted to know was my credit rating and my assets and the value of the house, and that I could breathe, basically. That was it.
But give us then the layout of the numbers that put you in the midst of. You got a house here for $460,000. You had little or nothing down on it. And what did your budget look like once you stepped into that mousetrap?
Well, it was crazy. And I'll explain in a minute why I thought I had a shot at pulling this off. But the basic numbers were that this mortgage was going to, it was actually a pair of mortgages, were going to cost me a combined total of about $2,600 a month, $2,600 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my take-home pay from the New York Times after paying, you know, all that child support and alimony, and it was withheld automatically, right?
Mm-hmm. $4,000 or so in alimony and child
support.
Yeah,
I was paying
$4,000
a month in child support and alimony. So that left me, after taxes and everything else, with a take-home pay of about $2,777. And
barely more than your mortgage payments.
Yeah, exactly. So my paycheck essentially would have to go, all of my paycheck would go entirely to the mortgage. Our theory was, Patty and I, our idea was, okay, it's very tough, it's very risky, but Patty's going to, you know, when she moves here from Los Angeles to move in, Patty is going to, you know, jump into the workforce, and if she can make $40,000 a year, maybe a little bit more, but if she can make $40,000 a year, $3,000 a month net that she would be bringing would, yeah, we would be able to pull it off. That actually was excessively optimistic right there. Our expenses turn out to be higher than that, no matter how you cut it. But the real magical thinking that we had allowed ourselves to be lulled into was that Patty could jump right into the labor force. She was very well educated. She was trained as a bookkeeper, but she had been a stay-at-home mom
for a long time,
for more than 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so she was going back into the labor force, and on top of that, she was changing cities. And, you know, it was kind of wildly unrealistic on both our parts. But when you're in love, you really don't want to be told that you can't do something. You just get obsessed about it. And so I had these guys ready to make it all possible. And I knew that this was the absolute biggest gamble of my life. But on the other hand, I was going for the biggest opportunity for love in my life, and I decided I was going to go for it.
When you're in love, you say you don't want to be told you can't do something. But was that the, I don't know, American disease overall in these years? Not everybody was in a brand new, fresh, you know, brimming love, but a lot of people apparently didn't want to be told they couldn't do something, like have that house they couldn't afford.
I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, we all have are individual stories. You know, people who got into trouble, everybody has a slightly different story. But Patty actually was the one who suggested to me that, you know, kind of the fever of being in love is kind of like, in a lot of ways, the fever for, buying a house or speculating on a house. In other words, you take a little risk at first with the person, letting them know that, you know, you're attracted to them. And if that pays off, you sort of go a little further and you make bigger commitments to that person. And likewise, you know, when you're looking at financial risks, if the first one works out, at first modest risk works out kind of well, you know, that was okay. So you go a little deeper the next time. And if it pays off, you know, you get more invigorated and more passionate and more fevered. And there is something, you know, basically totally hormonal about buying a house, too. I mean, it is so much a part of our psyches. And for us, for me, you know, the powerful thing was that we could have enough room for our kids and start this, you know, idyllic, blissful love life.
You could have it all, except you couldn't.
All.
And Andrews, we got a lot more to learn here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about living the housing bust from the inside with New York Times economics reporter Ed Andrews, who himself got caught in the collapse. Ed joins us from New York, and there's a lot of people, Ed, with tips for you. Jim, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, you're on the air with Ed Andrews.
Hi, Tom. I'm not sure I have any tips for him, except make money from his book, I hope.
Okay. How do you see what's going on out there, Jim?
Well, I have for some time been in the business of buying foreclosures and rehabbing them and reselling them. And so it's made my business a lot better, and I certainly feel sorry for the people that that have lost their homes, and I sympathize with them, but my end of the business is pretty good, and we still can sell houses. We do a lot of low-income stuff. I doubt we did anything. If he borrowed $500,000, he probably bought us $600,000 or $700,000 house. So, and we don't do a lot in that.
Do you see a trail of tears out there that precedes your business on reselling these foreclosures, Jim? Is it a national tragedy or just the way of the world?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. It's a national tragedy and it is the way of the world. We are helping. The folks that are in my business are helping bring the housing market back. As an example, we've bought some houses in the Fort Myers area of Florida, and we see the prices, which were extremely low,
right,
now creeping back up. And they've increased from their lows about 20% in the past couple of months.
That's a pretty good bump.
So that's good for everybody, I think.
What's the lesson Ed and the country ought to take from this hellacious ride we've taken in the last year or two on housing?
There ain't no free lunch. That's all there is to it. I mean, everybody was getting something for nothing, and you know, I'm not very liberal. I think it was caused by government policies of lowering the standards for loans. Started in the low income market where I primarily work, and it expanded into jumbo loans, and there were just no standards. And as Tom has already said, he didn't get a credit check. I mean, except his credit report. There was no credit check made, no analysis of the loan, and he's paying for it now, and everybody's paying for it now.
And you see maybe a bump on the way out, and we can hope so. Jim, thanks for calling, and good luck to you. Ed, a lot of people have been listening to you, not just here, but around. They get a chance to talk to you now. Let's go to Eric in Northampton, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just want to comment that this is a quote-unquote well-educated person with appalling judgment, judgment that my 16-year-old son wouldn't come close to. If I was this guy's boss, his job would be in jeopardy. This is an embarrassing example of poor judgment. I mean, not even adolescent judgment. That's all I have to say. I mean, it's if this is an example of a good education, it shows you what a good education is worth.
What does it mean, Eric? What does it mean that millions of Americans found themselves in similar circumstances?
Well, I think of a very poor example of judgment. But I mean, this is a theoretically well-educated person. A lot of these other people weren't well-educated. But there's something called judgment, which is just so lacking here that, I mean, why buy his book? There's nothing to learn from it.
Absolutely nothing. Eric, you're a tough audience, but it's we appreciate the comment. Ann Andrews, is your job in danger, sir? Has your editor looked at this and said, for crying out loud, what kind of economics editor couldn't see this coming, or reporter?
As far as I know, my job is not in danger, except for the fact that the newspaper industry itself is really struggling. I take Eric's, you know, comment. It's a natural one.
Appalling judgment.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not going to. I laid it out there with brutal honesty. This was a dreadful financial decision, and you know, that's sort of the starting point for the whole story. The reason I wrote Busted was not to try to make people feel sorry for me or try to rationalize what I was doing. The reason I wrote the book, besides the fact that I really did hope to make some money maybe and work my way out of some of this debt, but the thematic reason that I was very compelled to do this was I thought that I could, I had a unique vantage point from being inside of all this and also as a reporter who's been covering it to tease out the underlying story of how this was possible. How was it possible for me to be willing to take on so much risk? But more importantly, really, why were all these people willing to lend me the money so eagerly, so willingly? And of course, you know, this was a systemic thing. It wasn't just me. I was just one example among millions. And what I did to try to answer that question, or at least shed a little light on it, was to actually dig into the stories of the lenders who had made those loans and the Wall Street guys behind them. And to Eric's point about bad judgment, I will cop to the bad judgment on my part, but I will also tell you with no apologies that, you know, whatever bad judgment I made and whatever bad judgment, you know, other people in trouble made, it pales, absolutely pales in comparison with, you know, the reckless cynicism and misjudgment on the part of the Wall Street guys who were pushing that money into the mortgage market.
Well, paint that picture, because you heard Jim in Myrtle Beach say that from his point of view, it was caused by bad government policy, lowered standards for loans, even for jumbo loans. He looks at the crisis, the meltdown, and lays it at the feet of government policy.
Well, I would agree that government policy contributed to all of this in a very deep, fundamental political way. Home ownership has been viewed as apple pie, mom and apple pie, and, you know, an unmitigated good. And so, you know, everybody in both parties has been of the view that you should do anything that boosts the overall rate of home ownership is therefore a good thing. And because of that, the government, in its many regulatory aspects and its, you know, economic policymaking aspects, refused to do anything to restrain, you know, outrageously loose lending guidelines by the banks and the Wall Street firms. But I would also say that I don't think this was fundamentally government-driven. I think this was absolutely a case of the private sector driving it. In fact, the government, you know, sponsored institutions, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which, you know, have been cataclysms in their own right, I view them as being more the victims of the practices that were generated outside in the subprime market and the market for the exotic loans, because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac weren't really doing that kind of stuff. They were guaranteeing, you know, plain vanilla 30-year fixed rate mortgages and a kind of very conventional adjustable rate mortgages. The wild and crazy stuff was happening in the private arena where people were looking for new profits, new frontiers to make. And that ended up being what drove, you know, the whole country. Subprime lending just exploded into a multi-trillion dollar business. And truthfully, I have to say that one of the lessons here is that government regulation is vital to keeping the financial markets intact. And I think what we're heading back to is more regulation. There's a very fine balance between not restricting kind of creativity and innovation in financial services and allowing just self-destructive, reckless behavior on the part of institutions as well as individuals.
And let me ask you, Ed, you talked about cynicism around this on Wall Street when it was going on within the banks. I mean, people say to you and wonder about you, what did you think was going to happen here, Ed Andrews, economics reporter? But what about them, the bankers who were involved in this? As it just got bigger and bigger, became more and more of their business, what, from your research, what did they think was going to happen at the end of this story?
As far as I can make out, the most vivid conversations I've had with people have been on the lender level, and they're kind of midway up the food chain. A lot of those people were telling me, what we thought, we knew that the housing market was going to cool down and that, we wouldn't have these kinds of increases in home prices, but we never expected that housing prices would actually go down. Now, that is a fundamental fallacy number one. After years when 10 years really, when housing prices have been climbing at way above any historical norm for prices. In other words, climbing much, much faster than the rate of inflation.
You may be forgiven, even though you're an economics reporter, for thinking that. But what about the bankers, the top bankers? That they're supposed to understand that things go up and down.
Yeah. That's what I thought. And I thought that the smart money guys, they might be cynical, but what they were doing, they would make these loans and sell them as fast as they could, and then they would know how to get out before, everything went off a cliff. I figured that's what the smart money people might be cynical, they might even be evil, but, they weren't stupid, and that they were going to know when to get out. Actually, what happened, of course, was that the smart money people ended up doubling up a lot of the time at the very end. My first mortgage lender was an amazing story. This company, American Home Mortgage, had been a kind of a rocket of a company.
For whom their representative Bob said, "We're here to enable dreams."
That's right. These guys were not really subprime lenders. They were so-called Alt-A lenders. They would lend to people like me who had good credit scores but basically wanted to stretch beyond, any normal banking guidelines.
Yeah.
And they had grown by, at a gangbuster rate in the last couple of years. And they were up to about doing $60 billion a year in loans. Now, here's the thing. As the market started really getting bubbly in 2004 and 2005, they decided it wasn't good enough to just make the loans and sell them quickly for a profit. They decided they wanted a piece of that income stream, so they decided to hold the loans. And not only that, but because they weren't really a bank, they needed to borrow the money to hold the loan. So these guys built up a $15 billion portfolio of their own very riskiest mortgages. I mean, the absolute riskiest mortgages that they were making. And they were financing that $15 billion portfolio of mortgages 80-85% with borrowed money. So
if you were over your head, so were they.
Yeah, it was just incredible. I mean, this just boggles my mind. And I have to say, on a gut level, I go back and forth in my mind. Were the financial leaders, the big institutions, just incredibly stupid, or were they, recklessly cynical? And I, you look at the guys at American Home Mortgage, you go, I don't know, you know, stupid is the only explanation. But at a higher level, at the Wall Street level, where the analytical issues were totally clear, I have just absolutely no doubt about that. I think it was brazen, reckless cynicism. The numbers could not be justified in any reasonable way. And the further I dug into kind of the structure of these securities, that these pools of high risk loans, the crazier they looked.
Though you have to make those characterizations with a little more humility yourself these days, Ed.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, if you read the book, you will find that I don't actually whack any individuals who are lenders or Wall Street guys. Well, I take a few small shots.
Hey, we're all for whacking where the system went wrong. I mean, you're getting your licks here, too. Your whacks here, too.
Right.
Let's get some callers in here, Ed, if I may. So many want to talk with you. Wendy, Wilmington, New York. You're on the air, Wendy. Hi, Wendy. Are you there? Wendy may have moved on. Let's go to Frank in Boston. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
I always wanted to say that.
Right. Well, now you have. What do you know, Frank?
Okay. Well, I would say one other observation is that I've been there, and I think my advice to you, Mr. Andrews, is that we'll come back. People like you and I, you know, we are pretty much one of the pillars of the American society. We do take risks, some small risks. I mean, buying a home, you know, protecting your family, working hard, those are the American dream. I'm a first-generation American, Haitian-American.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of Haitians have fallen in the same trap. We come here, we try to, you know, work hard and have a home and say, this is what I've done with my time here. But the system failed us. I mean, you know, who would have thought, you know, my house that I bought for $320,000 would be worth $200,000 now?
And what about those who say, you know, okay, maybe the system had its fault, but you or Ed should have known, should have been more wary when the market was so high, Frank. What do you say to them?
Well, I'm not going to argue that. I'm not going to have a counterbalance of view, except it happened. And unfortunately, a lot of really smart people did not see it coming. And how can I blame myself for not seeing it coming as well? All I wanted to do was own a home, and I wanted to pay my bills on time. But no, my wife lost her job, so therefore I lost my home.
It's rough, and it happens, and it's happened to millions of people. Frank, thank you for calling, a long-time listener, first-time caller. Ed, what do you say to Frank? We just got half a minute before the break, and do you still feel like a pillar of society if you did before, Ed?
Well, I don't know that I'm a pillar of society, and I hope that I'm not seen as a positive model for people either. Don't do what I did. But Frank is... I really appreciate what he's saying in a different way, which is that many, many, many people... let me back up. Again, I don't want anybody to feel sorry for me. I don't expect people to feel sorry for me. But I do think if you read half of the letters I'm getting from the people, other people who have been caught in this, you would feel sorry for a lot of them. And, you know, what we have here is enormous numbers of surprising, you know, hardworking, honest people who made misjudgments and are really struggling.
Ed, hold the thought right there. The new book is Busted. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Let's hear from some listeners. Stephanie in Charleston, South Carolina. Stephanie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't buy a house that was more expensive than we could afford. Actually, whenever we bought, we said, we want to spend $180,000. Can you give us that much? Because we knew people that were being offered the $400,000.
And yeah,
we didn't know if we could resist. But we did kind of use the housing boom to finance our lifestyle, in that we borrowed a lot of money for vehicles and for other consumer things. And then ended up rolling that into our house,
yep.
Because of the boom and everything. And now we're kind of stuck in a position that the banks are really adamantly wanting that money back. And we're stuck in our house that we can't move. I'm in Charleston. My husband's in the military, and he had to transfer by himself because our house is upside down. We can still afford to make the payment, but we can't afford to sell it.
How far upside down? How much less is it worth than what you owe?
Well, we're really lucky. It hasn't been that big of a downturn here. So we're just maybe about $20,000 upside down. Not bad.
But you haven't lost your house, unlike Ed, who's stopped making his payments and is now just sort of waiting for the foreclosure guys to come. That's not your situation.
No, that's not our situation, but like I said, we did kind of finance a lot of consumer debt in knowing that, well, we're going to sell the house in 3 years, and then we'll get the equity out of the house, and then we'll pay off the debt because we did it once before. It worked. Why wouldn't it work this time?
When you look back on all those goodies, on the toys, on the vehicles, everything you bought, do you feel silly now? Do you feel stupid? Or?
I do. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because now, it's come time that we have to pay this money. We can't get any more money. The debt-to-income ratio is looked at a lot more closely, and now our credit rating has really gone through the floor, and we're left with some things that we're having a lot of trouble paying right now.
Party's over. But, you're stuck in the house, and your husband transferred elsewhere. Good luck with that whole scene, Stephanie. You and a lot of others. Ed, describe for us, if you would, when it began to come apart in your case, your grappling, your struggle to try to hold it together, though in the end you haven't. What measures did you take?
I'll answer that right away. The real catastrophe in our situation came in 2006 when my wife had finally acquired actually a pretty well paying job, and she lost it overnight in about October of 2006, and suddenly we had a catastrophic fall in income. We had barely begun to dig ourselves out of debt. We could see a path forward, but it was going to take years. And then suddenly, boom, her income is gone, and we were really in trouble. Basically,
a pretty rocky patch for your new marriage right there, too, as you described.
The toll it took on us was unbelievable. It's a miracle in some ways that we didn't break up because we were at each other's throats. I mean, when you have that kind of money stress year after year, and this is now a saga that has been going for 4 years for us, it brings out the worst in you. It really does. Money just tears people apart, and it almost destroyed us. We have been able to hold it together, and I love Patty very much, and I think we will make it through. Whether our house does, I don't know. To hang in there, I borrowed about $15,000 at one point from my mother, who I had a very small inheritance. She's in control of it, and she fronted me that money. I got lucky with a few other things, a bonus from the Times here, a big tax refund there. When Patty did lose her job, she had a small amount of 401k money she was able to use immediately without she did have to pay a tax penalty, but she could tap it. Stuff like that. Anything we could do, we did do to keep current. And so we were able to hold it together in a manner of speaking up until October of 2008. So 2 years after she lost her job was when we really went 30 days behind, and it got worse after that.
And stopped making payments, and now you're sitting there sort of waiting for the bank guys to show up. We'll hear about that. Vivian in Virginia Beach, Virginia. You're on the air, Vivian.
Hi.
Hi.
I read your piece in the New York Times, and I also I studied economics, and I thought yours was the one story, I really heard that I can understand why you got into the situation that you did, even given your financial knowledge and everything else. My question was, and I don't know if you mentioned it in your book, but you mentioned how one of the reasons you lost a lot of your income was because you were paying alimony and child support. But your wife, who had three children, wasn't she receiving alimony and child support from her ex-husband?
That is Patty with the four kids. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you are hitting a hot button issue for me.
Vivian knows where the tender spot is.
I was curious about that because you basically were taking care of two households.
That's right. And basically the story on that is that Patty's ex-husband, who is a commercial producer in Hollywood, with kind of an erratic, I guess, job history. He got away with convincing a court he should only pay $700 a month in child support. And they had four children,
and you were paying $4,000 a month in alimony.
But he was chronically delinquent. I mean, we would have been happy to have the $700 a month, but we almost never got it, you know. And he would actually take Patty to court to ask for less money, and then the court would get so mad at him that they would bump up the amount he owed. But he's thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars behind, and because we're on a different coast, you'd think we could. We would be able to retrieve some of that, but it just hasn't happened. 4 years, and he gets away with it. So, you know, that's the short answer there.
The short hairs too. Vivian, you know where the tender stuff is. What about the bankers now? Are they on your case? Are they knocking at the door? Do you expect them any day? You stopped paying, as I understand, last October, your mortgage.
That's right.
They must be reading the Times too. They know you're out there, I guess, unless you're
right.
Just a number in a big pile.
Yeah. Well, my current bank. I have, you know, basically two mortgages, but my primary mortgage is with J.P. Morgan Chase now, and I contacted them in October, and I said, look, you know, I'm behind, I'm going to hit 30 days, and, here's my situation. They offered a really nutty, you know, repayment thing, which would basically mean that I pay higher monthly payments for 6 months to catch up on, you know, whatever I was behind, and they said, in terms of a loan modification, you know, a new deal, we can't even think about that until you're 90 days past due. So, you know, I go, well, I guess, you know, really, I need to wait until I'm 90 days past due. And that's what I did. When come January, February, March, I'd get back on the phone with them. I'd given them basic information. And they were so overloaded that they were actually quite polite and nice. And they said, you know, we're sorry, we've got our negotiators, our analysts have about 500 cases per person, and we're just backed up. We will get to you, but just bear with us. And about the time I was wrapping up the magazine excerpt for the book in early April, about a month ago, the PR people at J.P. Morgan Chase realized what I was working on and started hustling the process up for me. But we're still, you know, we're still trying to sort it out with them.
Do you expect to come home someday and have, you know, the tape across the door, the new padlock, or are you in a privileged position as now such a public figure that you get to work out a special sweetheart deal?
No, I'm actually worried day by day that, you know, that's going to happen. I'm terrified that we're going to go from sort of no activity to suddenly being locked out of the house. And I have to give myself some blame here. There's a package of material that I had hoped to get out about 2 weeks ago to J.P. Morgan, and I haven't gotten it out yet. I've got it all ready to go, finally, but they haven't gotten it yet. So, truthfully, they haven't had the chance that they wanted to really go into the details of the whole thing. They will. And I so far, they've been very civil, and I would hope that we will have a discussion about that, and if it does come to losing the house, that, you know, we'll know about it enough in advance to at least make logistical plans. I very much hope that we hold on to it, and, you know, maybe the book will do so well that we can ride this out. That would be really, you know, sort of deus ex machina, you know, like a just, you know, God coming to the rescue. But I hope we hold on to it, and we'll just have to see. If I didn't have the book, I would bet that we would not hold on to it that much longer. But who knows?
Who knows for you and a lot of others? Let's go to Bradenton, Florida, and Mark. Mark, you're on the air with Ed Andrews.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The question I have is that American Home Loan, how much money did the principals of that company walk away with when their company went under?
American Home Mortgage Corporation, did it go under? And
yes.
What did they walk away with? Do you know, Ed?
Oh, I do. I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but American Home Mortgage became the second biggest corporate bankruptcy in the United States in 2007. It collapsed overnight when the financial crisis really began in July, August of 2007. Their credit lines dried up, and they folded overnight because of that huge leveraged portfolio of loans that they were holding.
Did they have super rich execs go away like Countrywide and others?
You know, the thing about them is very few of them sold stock before they before the whole thing collapsed. So there was not much cashing out. There was one guy who, I think, cashed out about $14 million in stock before he before the end. He was not the chief executive, but he was way up there. But most of the other ones did not cash out. And in fact, there were some of them who were buying stock as recently as, you know, 6 months before the end. I've asked a couple of those people, why the heck you know, didn't you start unloading your stock?
Yeah.
Couldn't you see this coming? They you know, a couple of them told me, no, we really thought, you know, this would be a storm, but we would, you know, we'd come out stronger for it in the end.
And they didn't. Let's go to Bronwyn in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bronwyn, you're on the air with Ed Andrews.
Hi. Sad story, very sad, but I have a big picture question.
Yes, please.
Suppose we all agree that we really need intelligent oversight and regulation. My question is, where do you get those people? Isn't everybody who has the intelligence and the interest to put in the time to even understand these new and weird and strange and complicated financial instruments, that aren't all those people, or almost all of them, whether they're ethical or unethical, going to be in the business? Why would they want to step out of the business and become regulators?
I mean, be in the banks, though. I mean, you may give the banks too much credit because they got crunched here in the end, too. So, but let us pick it up. Ed, you know, maybe they'll be bankers instead of regulators, or is anybody smart enough to regulate this properly? There were regulations before. They just weren't good ones that were well observed.
Right. I think, you know, the caller has raised a really good question. It's a perennial one. The regulators of an industry very, very often become captives of the industry, and that's absolutely what happened in the couple of decades before this crisis hit. But my answer to that partly would be, you know, this isn't that complicated. There were some really basic principles that regulators did not address. The simplest one of all being, you've got to document that a borrower has, you know, a realistic possibility of being able to repay that loan.
You know, that's true. It's not rocket science at that level. I remember the radio ads. They were all over commercial radio. No proof of income required in inviting people to come to apply for mortgages. I mean, it's
right
on the radio. It doesn't take a brain surgeon to hear that and think, what?
And it's not just the no doc loans. It's also, you know, there were all kinds of cockamamie loan programs that allowed you to make very low payments for the first couple of years, and then you get sucked like crazy down the road. I mean, stuff that made absolutely no sense.
But still, Bronwyn has a point, doesn't she? I mean, there's a big argument in the whole field of economics about just how effective regulation can be.
Yes, there is, and I would bet that at some point, we will have the weird phenomenon of regulation that in some ways is too harsh and too restrictive and rigid on the one hand, at the same time that you have banks, you know, or financial institutions coaxing out absurd favors from the government that make no sense either. In other words, they're giving and clamping down with excessive force in both cases. But that said, let me come back to this. You know, basic principle of a person's ability to repay a loan. You know, the traditional way was to, you know, sort of document their income, figure out a relationship between that income, which, you know is going to change over time, but a relationship between that income at the time of the mortgage and the amount that they want to borrow. These are not hard concepts. The thing to remember here is, you know, people do get ahead of themselves. They get greedy. They make bad judgments. That's human nature. What's not just a natural function of human nature is where you have millions and millions of people at one time, all going just into crazy debt. Something systemically is wrong there, and that's what bears looking at. And like I say, you know, just that one principle, enforcing it, there are very, very simple ways to enforce the idea of ability to repay, documenting the ability to repay. And there are some other things that you could look at that aren't complicated that would have stopped a lot of this from happening.
Maybe that doesn't take geniuses if you just get the right latticework, the right structure in place. Ed Andrews, you have really opened the kimono here. Whatever people think of the path that got you in trouble, you've been generous in sharing your story and letting us take whatever lessons we will from it. And for that, we're grateful. Thanks for the book, Busted, Life Inside the Great Mortgage Meltdown. And thanks for being with us today, Ed. Good luck to you and Patty and the kids and everybody. Hope it works out for you and a whole lot of other people. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.